President Carter, good to see you again.
It's good to be with you and your many listeners.
I wonder if, first of all, you could just tell me about your first encounter with guinea worm. What did you see and what was your reaction?
Well, after leaving the White House, we didn't really know what the Carter Center would do. We thought at first that our goal would be just to resolve conflicts, that I would set up something like a little Camp David, so people that had a prospective civil war or an ongoing war could come to me and I would mediate between them and help bring peace. And we still do that. But I had a national drug czar when I was president named Dr. Peter Bourne. He was an expert on all the production of narcotics around the world and that sort of thing. And after we both left the White House, he went to the United Nations and became an assistant Secretary General of the United Nations. And so as an experienced medical doctor with knowledge of the world, they gave him the assignment of running the so-called Decade on Water. And they emphasized the importance of clean, fresh water to drink all over the world and how it adversely impacted on the lives of people. So one of the most intriguing cases that he discovered was dracunculiasis, or commonly known as guinea worm. He didn't know how far extensive it was. He just knew the dreaded impact of it. So he showed us some slides and movies. As a matter of fact, at lunch hour, most of us got nauseated. And afterwards, I told Peter to let me know who in the world was working on the disease. He said practically no one wants to fool with it because it's so horrible and so isolated in its impact. And it seems to be intransigent as far as resolving the problem. So we decided to take it on. So the Carter Center adopted guinea worm as one of our first health projects. And we were lucky to find Dr. Don Hopkins at the Centers for Disease Control, just a few hundred yards from the Carter Center, who had been a foremost leader in the eradication of smallpox. So he knew the technique of eradicating diseases and how he knew the foreign countries involved and so forth. So he came to work full-time for the Carter Center to take on this project first. Now he's in charge of all our health programs. So we began our efforts in Pakistan. We had the guinea worm disease we knew in India, Yemen, and Pakistan, plus the rest of it was sub-Saharan Africa. So we went to Pakistan. I had a friend there. There was a general, a dictator, you might say, of Pakistan, General Zia, and he knew me, and I told him this was a special project of mine. So he basically turned over the government to get rid of guinea worm in Pakistan. He sent his top general to the Carter Center for several weeks of instruction, and when he went back, he had almost carte blanche in Pakistan to eradicate guinea worm. And within 3 years, they had zero cases of guinea worm. That was the first proof. And later we had Yemen and India follow.
But if I may ask, so when was the first time you met an actual guinea worm patient?
Okay, the first time I ever saw a guinea worm case was in Ghana. Ghana had a high incidence of guinea worm. They had 176,000 cases, I remember. And one of the villages impacted, or endemic, we call it, was just about 2 or 3 hours' drive from the capital of Accra. So we went to that little village. It's about the size of Plains, Georgia, where I live, about 500 people. And 300 of its citizens had guinea worm. And they were assembled under the shade trees around the town square by the chief. I remember there were 22 of them who couldn't drag themselves out of their huts to meet with us. And so we talked to the chief, told him what we were doing there. And then I went around and visited the people who had guinea worms coming out of different parts of their body. The most memorable experience was a beautiful young woman, I think about 19 or 20 years old, and I thought she was holding a baby in her arms, and I went over to talk to her child, and I found out she was holding her right breast in her arm instead of a baby, and a guinea worm was coming out of a nipple of her breast, and she was in excruciating pain. We found out later that year that she had 11 other guinea worms emerge simultaneously from her body. We had a very rich man with us. And he said, look, this is such a horrible case. I will personally send my people in here to dig a deep well for these people. So he did, and they found water there. It's quite prevalent in the southern part of Ghana. So within 2 months, we had a deep well dug for them so people no longer had to drink water out of the filthy pond that contained the guinea worm eggs. We went back there 1 year later, zero guinea worm. And that village has never seen guinea worm since then. So
right,
that was
so
my first real experience in seeing guinea worm and seeing how easily it is to correct. In most cases, though, particularly in the northern part of Ghana and many other places, when you dig a well, you don't find water. So they have to continue to get water out of the contaminated water hole that fills up during the rainy season, and then they have to survive on that water the rest of the year.
But what a thing to witness. I mean, two-thirds of this village affected by guinea worm. This poor, poor woman with 11 worms, that must have left a really deep mark on you.
It did. I've never forgotten it, obviously. I speak with it. I get somewhat emotional just thinking about the sight of it. But since then, of course, I've seen hundreds of people with guinea worms emerging from their bodies. I think the most pitiful cases, though, are the little children, about the same age as my youngest grandchildren, you know, 3, 4 years old, with guinea worms coming out of their arms and legs and hips and between the thighs and in the knee joints. And the problem is that when a guinea worm emerges from the inside of a human body a year later, after they drink the water with eggs in it, then it destroys the muscle tissue. So the aftermath of guinea worm, say it comes out right behind the knee of a person, is permanent deformation, just like the aftermath of polio that I knew when I was a child. The child's whole limb will be withered, so they are crippled for life. The terrible part for a village or a nation is the adverse impact not only of human suffering but also economic deprivation. The World Bank did a study in one very small county in the midst of Nigeria, and they found that the guinea worm alone cost that county $20 million annually in lost revenue because the people couldn't go into the fields to plant the crop, to cultivate the crop, and to harvest their crop when they were afflicted with guinea worm. And, of course, no kids could go to school.
No question. It's a horrible disease. Of course, poor people in poor regions of the world suffer from many horrible diseases, and honestly, some of the others affect a lot more people and are actually deadly, where guinea worm generally is not deadly. Why take on guinea worm? I realize the Carter Center has taken on other diseases, yeah, too, but why target this one for eradication?
Well, now we have five other diseases. I need not name them just to save time, on which we are working. But guinea worm was a disease that is truly neglected, to use the same word that the World Health Organization applies to it and four other disease. In it, nobody much wanted to help with it. It's impossible for anyone to have guinea worm in a village where they have running water. If they have a stream there or a deep well there, no one will have guinea worm because the eggs only breed in stagnant water in a pond that fills up during the rainy season and then survives there without any circulation the rest of the year. So every village in the world that we have attended, now 23,600 of them, has been an isolated village with no other source of water in an extremely arid area of that state or of that county when the rainy season is over.
You were up in Lojira Village yesterday. They grow peanuts there, and in fact, they offered you some ground to cultivate.
Yes, they gave me some land. In fact, I've accumulated farms as gifts of the grateful villagers in many countries in Africa and two or three in Asia, where they want me to come back, you know, and start a groundnut farm next to that neighbor. They would like to have a rich former president being part of their community, but I appreciate it anyway. And this was a very great honor for me. And they also gave me the marks of a man, a manhood, that is a bow and arrow that they carry themselves, even though they don't hunt with the arrows, and I still have it over here with a spear. So I've always feel honored to be included in the, I'd say, in the general social life of a grateful community that has helped us eradicate their own guinea worm. The important thing about guinea worm, too, is that almost all of the decisions, almost all of the determination and persistence and patience and confidence and faith has to be among the people themselves. You can't have outsiders do that. We can tell them what causes guinea worm. They're just drinking the water out of their sacred pond. In fact, they look on the pond as part of their religious life, because if that rain pond hadn't been there, their village would not have existed. Their ancestors would not have lived, therefore they wouldn't be alive. So they look on the pond as sacred. So we had a lot of trouble at first by, I'd say, religious leaders, witch doctors and others, who thought that we were insulting their sacred ponds. And we had to convince them that the guinea worm was an insult to the pond, that the God, their gods wanted those ponds to be clean of this infection that punished his own people. So we had to go through some kind of a philosophical or theological explanation in order to convince them on occasion.
Well, speaking of theology, guinea worm is not just a disease. It is a worm. It's an animal. And I presume you would say it's one of God's creatures. And so how do you reconcile that, that if this is one of God's creatures, how can you then want to exterminate it from the earth?
Well, I have to say that guinea worm is not only one of God's creatures, but it's recognized in the Holy Bible. It's known as the fiery serpent, and it was looked upon as a curse on God's chosen people. The fiery serpent was, just like devastating drought or leprosy. And I, in my opinion, as a Christian, I don't have any doubt that God approved it when Jesus, say, would heal a person who was blind, maybe with trachoma, or with a river blindness, or maybe healed a person who was afflicted with being crippled, maybe from a case of guinea worm earlier, or when Christ touched a person and healed their leprosy. So I don't have any feeling of guilt about eradicating, getting rid of one of God's creatures, all that was created, but I don't think it was destined to permanently injure or kill or cause severe pain among God's people.
You mentioned the word neglected, that yes. Guinea worm is a neglected tropical disease, and that is, people talk about that, neglected in essence by the developed world. How do you make the case to Americans who are worried about raising their kids and keeping a job and keeping their home? How can you make them care about a disease they've never heard of in a country that they'll probably never visit?
Well, I would surmise that I have the same problem in this task as you might have in gaining enthusiastic listeners just to hear about guinea worm, because it's not known. But when I was a child, my mother was a registered nurse, and I and my classmates, my relatives, everybody, were afflicted with trachoma, blindness. And we were afflicted with polio. We were afflicted with malaria. We very seldom survived from pneumonia. One of my favorite aunts died with an infection of her throat. Now those afflictions can be very easily controlled by antibiotics, medicines that we didn't have before, polio vaccines. So when I try to equate for, say, potential funders, the blight of guinea worm on people now when they never have heard of it, I can equate them to some degree. Well, you remember when you were a child, you had a danger of malaria or polio or smallpox, and now all of those diseases have been eradicated. Help us do the same thing for the people who are suffering in Africa.
So, in essence, it is the morally right thing to do.
I don't have any doubt about that, yes. I feel morally justified in leading this campaign based on the work of experts like Dr. Don Hopkins, who has taught me everything I'm able to recite to you so glibly. But it's a labor of love for me. And the almost immediate beneficial impact of a good guinea worm eradication program is extraordinary, in that if everyone in a village, no matter how many have the disease, 1 year, will stay out of the pond with their emerging guinea worms, the next year they will have zero guinea worms, because this particular affliction has to go through a human body only in order to repeat itself the following year. So luckily for us and for the world, it doesn't depend upon going through goats or cattle or other animals that might drink the water. It has to be a human body for some reason.
So if I might ask one final question. Mm-hmm. This is a critical time in Sudan. This is a rare window of peace in many decades of war, which has enabled you to come in and do the work on guinea worm eradication. Should fighting erupt again, and there is concern about violence, what would that mean for your goal of eradicating guinea worm from the planet?
It'll be a major setback for us. But you have to remember that the first time we came here and began to eradicate guinea worm, there was a horrible civil war going on that cost 2.3 million lives. And we had 110,000 cases of guinea worm then. We had the Comprehensive Peace Agreement concluded in 2005, And we did another survey a year later. We only had about 20,000 cases then. So what we did in the interim was to send in to Southern Sudan, where we couldn't go, 9 million pipe filters, little tiny pipe filters that you see me wearing around my neck. So everyone who didn't have a big filter cloth to put over the mouth of a jug or the head of a bucket could wear that little pipe filter, and every time they drank a drink of water out of a filthy pond, they would suck the water through that pipe or straw, and the water would be filtered. So when we finally got back into Sudan, we found that those pipe filters had made a tremendous beneficial impact on the incidence of guinea worm in the endemic villages. So that was how we did it, almost in absentia. And so that was a very important thing for us to do. And I induced John Garang, who was a revered leader of South Sudan, always to wear a pipe filter around his neck to show his people that they ought to do the same thing. But we were able to have, as I said, 9 million of those pipe filters made for us, sponsored by the government of Norway, and they were actually put together by women in Nairobi in Kenya and then shipped into Southern Sudan.
But if fighting breaks out, that will be a setback.
It will be a setback. We have to have security. Otherwise, the people will take their minds off guinea worm live in the villages, and also our volunteer workers. We now have 12,600 volunteer workers. They would turn their attention to other things other than eradicating guinea worm, and some of our professionals couldn't go in. And in a period of fighting, if we send in a pickup truck or a motorcycle or something to deliver supplies or to carry messages, then that's very likely to be confiscated by warriors on both sides who want it for military benefit. So, yes, we are very deeply concerned, not only for the well-being of the Sudanese people, but also for the guinea worm program, that peace prevail.
President Carter, thank you for your time.
I've enjoyed it talking to you. You asked some good questions. Thank you very much.